Welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. I am your hostess, Erin Quayle, and this week I invited an old friend of mine, a friend and colleague, Christina Iovani, to the podcast. She is a certified thanatologist, which means grief and loss. So since the last episode of Orange is the New Black season 4 focused so heavily on the grieving process, not only for fans, but also for the characters on the show after the loss, the devastating loss of Pusey, we kind of decided to break up the discussion of the finale into two parts. So the first part is a conversation that I had with Jamie Broadnax of Black Girl Nerds, and that can be found, wherever you access this podcast, on iTunes, Stitcher, through Hidden Remote, through the website. It's just the previous podcast to this one. But on this episode, we got really deep, not only about grief and loss as it relates to the episode, but we kind of used Orange is the New Black as kind of a doorway to explore grief and loss in general and all the different theories behind it. If you've taken Psych 101 or any classes on grief and loss throughout your years, or even if you just kind of know about it or have stumbled on it, there'll be some familiar names here, such as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and John Bowlby. We talk about those theories, but we also kind of open it up, and I learned some things about grief and loss, and Christina's a really great teacher, so she's really enthusiastic about the subject. So we talk about all sorts of different things, about whether or not it's okay to grieve for a fictional character. It's definitely okay to grieve for a fictional character, but like how best to go about doing that. Personally, I have a really hard time with grief and loss for fictional characters, as well as, just in my own life too. I lost a dog, I think about 10 years ago, and I'm still kind of not over it. So, Christina walks us through all the different processes through that, and how we can kind of go through the mourning process and get back to a life where we can kind of come to terms with our loss and be comfortable with that. So I hope you guys enjoy the talk, and just a reminder that even though this is the last Orange is the New Black podcast focusing on a specific episode of season 4, we're going to continue on. We're going to do an episode on, I believe I mentioned this before, on an arts program in the New York prison system, and we're also, hopefully going to do one on addiction, one on trauma, as the months go by and we get closer to season 5 of Orange is the New Black, hopefully dropping next summer. I know they're filming now, so we're definitely looking forward to that. So if you'd like to reach us in the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast. And also you can just send us an old-fashioned email at you've got time podcast@gmail.com. So thanks so much, and I hope you guys enjoy this talk, because I definitely did. All right, bye. I know each other from previous counseling experience and all that, so so I know you, but our listeners don't yet know you, so if you could just give a little bit of background, that would be great.
Sure. So I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm also certified in the field of thanatology. I got my certification in 2011 through ADEC, which is the Association for Death Education and Counseling. I'm currently running intensive outpatient groups at Yale. One of the groups that I run each week is a grief and loss group, which I actually call it Coping with Loss.
That's great. Yeah, it's funny because I got an email one day at the agency we both used to work at, and it was like, Christina is running a group on like grief and loss, and da-da-da. And I was like, I didn't even know that was really a thing until I got the email, and I was like, it makes total sense, obviously, because grief and loss is such a big part of a lot of counseling, whether or not people want to like address it or not. But I didn't really know that it was a field of study.
It is. And a lot of people don't know about it. What's actually kind of funny is that, you know, my credentials say LCSW, CT, and people always assume it means Connecticut, but it actually means it actually means certified thanatologist.
Oh, wow.
And so instead of saying certified thanatologist, I do explain it as certification in thanatology, because generally people don't really know what thanatology is. So,
yeah.
Thanos, deriving from the Greek word death, is a study of death, dying, and bereavement. So, the Association for Death Education and Counseling, they offer certifications along with fellowships.
Okay.
So, you would be able to, as a fellow, you would be able to teach and help to certify individuals who are interested in learning about the field. And as somebody who has a certification, I'm able to basically run groups, do some individual work with people. And yeah, that's pretty much
awesome.
It. Yeah, that's something
that's
I really enjoy.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's so helpful too. You know, like I've, you know, we, in my groups, we would deal with grief and loss sometimes, like say, you know, a celebrity died or something, like when Michael Jackson died, like that was a big thing. Like, cause especially,
I know.
Me working in the substance abuse arena, like, you know, whenever a celebrity dies from an overdose or something with, you know, so we would deal with it then. Or if, you know, if someone, you know, all too often, unfortunately, we would have group members lose someone to, you know, a shooting or, you know, or something like that. So we would definitely process it and go through all the stages and sort of help people, you know, process the way they need to process. But you know, my philosophy, and, you know, I'm sure I've talked about it on the podcast before, but my philosophy is just to kind of come at everyone the way that they are. And so, but I don't have that specialized background in grief and loss that would potentially make, you know, counseling or, you know, consulting a little bit more effective, I think.
Well, that's actually the best way to go about dealing with loss is, you know, dealing with it on an individual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really the most misconceived part is that, you know, everybody sort of, it's a societal thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have this idea that, you know, certain things you should just get over, you know, like the loss of a fictional character or the loss of a pet.
Oh, God, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, even miscarriages, you know, and things like that are in the field what we would consider disenfranchised grief. So things that society doesn't see as really all that important or, you know, not worthy of as intense mourning as maybe the loss of an individual.
Right.
So, excuse me, you know, something else would even be the loss of a role or the loss of a responsibility, like losing a job, divorce. Those are all things that might be considered as disenfranchised grief.
Oh, wow. That's actually, I've never heard that term before. So that's really interesting to me to kind of hear that because, you know, it, I mean, it makes total sense too. It's like, you know, our society as a whole, and we'll definitely get to like cultural differences between grief and loss, but you know, the United States, our society is kind of like you said, kind of like, okay, like you have this period of time, you grieve, you move on and that's it. Like I know.
Exactly.
My cousin passed away like a lot, like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when I was working at a counseling agency. And I remember she was like as close to me as my sister. And I remember they were like, okay, you have one bereavement day. I was like, I have one bereavement day, like one, like I can't, like, there's no, like, I need to take unpaid days because there's no way I can have one day.
Oh no, I feel like I'm coming down with the flu. I think I might need some sick days.
And actually to my supervisor's credit, she did allow me to use some of my sick days and like, just kind of like didn't like turn the other way. But I remember having like to fight, like I had a couple losses in a row and I remember having to fight for some of those days and being like, are you kidding? Like I, you know, so just as personal experience, I definitely understand that disenfranchised grief because it's like, okay, your cousin died, so you don't get as many days as if like you're close, like your sister, you know? And it's like,
right.
Who's making those judgments, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I had a coworker at one time who her cat passed away. Mm-hmm. And she didn't have any kids of her own. Oh. And, you know, for those of us who have pets, they're mm-hmm. they're just like our children. And, yeah. you know, when she asked to take a bereavement day, and this was at the job that you and I both worked at, mm-hmm. she was told at the time, you know, basically her supervisor laughed. Yeah. Like, really? You want to use a bereavement day for your cat? Like, it's your cat. Come on. Like, get another one. Mm-hmm. And, it's not – I actually had a patient of mine who came – he was suicidal, and he came into the intensive outpatient program because his cat had passed away a year ago.
Yeah.
And absolutely 100% dead serious. Anytime he would talk about this cat, he would break down. He would start mm-hmm. crying. It was devastating. And so that was something that I gave him. He had so much strength to be able to share that yeah. in front of people when other people in this group were talking about, well, you know, my boyfriend committed suicide mm-hmm. and I feel like I had something to do with it. Or, mm-hmm. you know, my mom passed away of cancer a couple of years ago and here he is talking about his cat. And, mm-hmm. You know, there are things that are really meaningful to us. And when we lose them, it is devastating. So yeah, I think go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I just think it's, you know, it's definitely... It's the meaning to you. So, right. you know, some people might lose a parent. Like, I don't know if you watch that show, like, Veep, but there's an episode where, like, a very, like, kind of, like, cold character loses her mom, and she doesn't, like, react at all. Like, she's not... Mm-hmm. I mean, she does, but she doesn't. And it's like, okay, sometimes people can lose a parent, and there's nothing. And right. then some people can lose a pet, and it's everything. Because, right. you know, and even the same person can react differently to two different things that are very, like, societally marked as, like, okay, your mom, like, that should be tough for you, and your cat, like, that should be easy for you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are these perceptions that things should be hard or easy, and they do prevent people from fully expressing or dealing with their grief, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that sort of... says a lot about just people in general. We have these expectations about ourselves. We have these expectations about others and how we're supposed to deal with things or what should or shouldn't bother us. And the fact of the matter is, regardless of what the issue is, we're all different and everybody deals mm-hmm. with things differently. Everybody is affected by things differently. And that's what's most important. So you have to really truly meet the individual where they're at and not mm-hmm. where you think they should be.
Right, right. Yeah, for sure. And I do think that having some sort of framework of grief and loss is helpful too. And I know, like, I went to psych classes or whatever when I was, in school. So I obviously know about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who's like a huge, and some people who didn't even go to psych classes might even know about her because her stages of grief and loss are so famous. But, can you kind of briefly work us through those? Because I'm sure that's probably something that you do in your coping with grief.
Yeah. Absolutely. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was really one of the pioneers in the field of thanatology. And she discusses the five stages of grief. Mm-hmm. And she came up with the acronym, which is DABDA, which really mm-hmm. helps me to remember it. The acronym is for the first stage being denial, the second stage being anger, mm-hmm. B is for bargaining, D, the second D is depression, and mm-hmm. then A for acceptance. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that she really stressed in these stages is that it's not linear. Mm-hmm. Like most models, you know, things are, they can happen at different times. Some stages might repeat themselves. You know, mm-hmm. you might be in denial early on after experiencing the loss, and then you may also relive that again later on. Mm-hmm. So it's important to know some people might experience all five stages. Some might go through them very quickly. Some might go from denial to acceptance. So again, it's important to look at the individual, and it's really helpful to look at it as a guideline. Mm-hmm. And I actually use the five stages to help people identify where they are as far as the grieving process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, also, what are some of the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that they experience, and mm-hmm. what can help them to move towards acceptance of the loss?
Mm-hmm. And kind of being able to be at peace with themselves, more or less.
That's really the ultimate goal, sure. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I think, you know, the stages of grief are kind of, if we're going to get into like the big, obviously the big loss in season 4 of Orange is the New Black, the last mm-hmm. episode of the season, episode 13, definitely shows a bunch of people in Litchfield going through the different stages of grief.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's, you know, obviously the core group of Pusey's friends who are really kind of dealing with it. And then there's little offshoots. But in your, you know, experience, you know, and I think, too, I think in a way they've kind of made it a little easy to kind of identify where people are at in the episode, because people are kind of in, you know, kind of talking about like, this is how I grieve and this is how I grieve and this is how I grieve, uh-huh. which is actually kind of good, I think, for people to start seeing, you know, even how like fictional characters are processing a loss of another fictional character, and that kind of helps people kind of move through too. But there's so many different reactions here, and so how would you say, like, you know, if you were to look at the different characters, like, where are the different, you know, some of the major characters at in their grief process?
Well, you can really see, I think, a lot of different things with Tacy. Mm-hmm. So Tacy is, I think, certainly in experiencing anger, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think a little bit, well, maybe not in denial. I think there were a couple, Cindy and the other friend.
Watson.
I can't think of her name right now. What's that?
I think her name's Watson, the one who runs.
Watson,
the track
yes.
star. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it wasn't Watson. The one who had, her hair was up, like in a bun at the top of her head. Was it, is it Cindy? Not Cindy.
Cindy has like the poofs, and she was eating, like she was like dealing with her grief by eating.
Actually, that is who I'm thinking of. It was Cindy. So Cindy was, what was I going to say? A little bit in denial about it. Same with Suzanne. So they, let's see, going back to Tacy. Mm-hmm. Tacy was definitely experiencing anger. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see that from the very beginning. Actually, I'm going to refer back to my notes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. She was in shock about it. She was getting really irritable with a couple of other characters, particularly with Suzanne, who I'll get into in just a second. But, you know, it seemed like she really wanted to be, focused on herself, and seeing anybody else grieving or consoling her was really irritating her. Mm-hmm. You know, at one point she started talking about how, you know, everyone's saying, oh, I'm sorry for your loss. It's not like, you know, my grandmother passed away. This was a murder. Mm-hmm. And so you clearly see the anger there.
And those scenes with her are just so beautiful. Like, I think I've talked about this before, but like her expression of her grief, and like, it's a very like layered way. Like you said, like she's kind of manifesting a lot of different stages at the same time.
Absolutely.
And she just the way, and I think, you know, that's definitely a testament to her actual friendship with Samira Wiley. I think maybe she probably pulled from that a little bit, but maybe not, because she's also a tremendous actress. But she, you know, she's really like, she connects the audience to the grief so much in this episode, I think. And I think it's a testament to the fact that she's really conveying a lot of those stages at the same time.
She is. And I think it's important for people to also know that, you know, we do focus a lot on those stages of grief. But there's also, you know, the processes that we go through. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even just kind of looking at other theorists, John Bowlby, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and Warden discussed the phases of mourning. And there's four phases here. The first one is shock and numbness. So that's the phase. And then there's tasks associated with the phase. So soon after a loss, you experience this shock and you're numb. And the task is being able to accept the fact that the person is no longer there. And typically people are kind of feeling detached from life. You know, it's this kick to the stomach almost. The second phase is yearning and searching. And I think this is sort of where you see some of the characters being able to work through the pain of grief. Some of them aren't really willing to acknowledge the loss because in this particular situation, it was very traumatic, which I know that we're going to certainly get to talking about that. And the reminiscing that they have about her, you know, talking about, you know, some of the stories that she's told and, you know, obviously her love of books and the library.
Her shiwi.
And then the next, I'm sorry?
Her shiwi invention. Her and shiwi. All
that. That was hysterical. I love that. So the next phase is disorganization and despair. And that's, you know, this focusing on the fact that this person is no longer in your life and who, you know, what is life like without that person? You know, you're just really lost. There's changes in your identifying who you are. Excuse me.
Right, without that person. Then,
exactly. Who am I? Right. Role changes. And then lastly is reorganization, and that's being able to kind of move on with your life and emotionally relocating that person to be able to move on with life. And hopefully we'll be able to see that in season five.
And it's hard, I think, you know, especially as, you know, vibrant and front and center as a character that Poussaid was, you know, it's nice that we have this opportunity to kind of grieve through the lens of all these different characters and kind of see what they're going through, because people can, I think, Orange is the New Black did that very well, because they gave different people opportunities to sort of identify with these different characters based on where they were at. So I think, you know, and I actually don't, I know Bowlby more, he's like attachment theory too, I think, right? He does the doll or whatever. But so I actually, I mean, I think I like had probably seen those stages in like a textbook or something, but I totally forgot about them. But yeah, but those kind of, those really make sense as well, because they also have those goals attached to them, which is really, or I'm sorry, what are the tasks attached
the tasks,
to them?
Yeah.
So, so that's a really nice way to frame it as well for people who are maybe really struggling and can't kind of need something to focus on.
Yes. And I think that that's really important, you know, to be able to process a loss is to be able to focus on moving forward. And how is it that you can create new meaning in your life, not necessarily focusing on your life as being, you know, void of the deceased person, but having had the experience to know that deceased person, how can you now create new meaning given the values and maybe knowledge that you've gained from that person and also from the experience. And I think that in episode 13, you really see that with Red. You know, Red read through, you know, a chapter or poem of one of the books that Poussaid had given her. And, you know, she also made that point, which I think is great and very realistic, keeping everybody busy. You know, she said, I sense trouble. And that was something that she did with her sons growing up is, you know, if you keep them busy, they're going to stay out of trouble. And I think that that's really important for people, but to use caution around that, because oftentimes we feel that we have to keep ourselves busy so that we don't feel. And in order to really process a loss, we have to. We have to be able to feel. We have to be able to feel the pain, knowing that that person was a part of our lives and is no longer going to be physically present, because that's how we move towards acceptance.
Right.
And I think Red does a really good job in this episode.
Right. Yeah. And I think to be kind of, I think Red is obviously, cause Red, I don't, out of all like the quote unquote white girls in the episode, like, I don't think very many of them were specifically close to per se. Like, I don't really think we see throughout the seasons, I don't really think we see her like make a specific bond with any of them, except for maybe Red. Like, we hear in retrospect that Pusey gave Red that book, and Pusey was always very thoughtful, and she did connect with other people, and you know, she was kind of like, just like, however, oh, I guess she connected with Judy King, but Judy King is like, whatever. But you know, I think it's interesting to know that, like, you know, Red and her quote unquote family aren't really necessarily as connected to Pusey as the, you know, as the black girl group is. And so we do kind of see them, you know, have some, like, I think Cindy says they're like sitting Shiva. And so we see them sitting and we see other women come and bring them things and, and sort of mourn in their own way and actually take the time to do it. But I think it's interesting to note that Tasty is actually the one who's like, I'm going to go and be busy.
Yeah.
So, but she does have a reason. She's going to be busy because she feels like she can affect change, which she kind of, she does, you know, she ultimately does at the end of the episode. But she, I mean, she's trying to do it in the proper channels. Like, she's trying to like move her grief through, you know, in terms of being useful to Caputo or moving Caputo along in like the humane way to deal with things. And she does get him to call Pusey's dad, which is obviously like a really sad part of the episode too. But but she is staying busy, and I wouldn't say that it's necessarily staying busy to like forget about it or to like it's staying busy for
not
a purpose.
At all. Yes, absolutely. And you know, just as anything is, because I think there is a misconception too, and again, kind of societal in nature, that you shouldn't be focused on anything other than the loss of the person, right? After somebody passes away, you know, it's first of all, death in general is taboo to talk about, but you know, people have their judgments, people have their opinions about what is and what is not appropriate after somebody dies. And again, the fact is people deal with things differently. So if somebody wants to, you know, have time to, think about it, talk about it with other people, and then still be able to, engage in work or a hobby or an activity to help them find their path and continue to move forward, that's okay. And I think that, you know, she has, you know, she's looking to help resolve the situation, by working with the warden. What's his name?
Caputo.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, obviously she wants to be able to help him and figure out what's going on, but I think it's also to sort of keep her busy because, again, you can see that other people approaching her or listening to other people, going through their own grieving process was really irritating her. So I think that she handled it, appropriately. And again, I'm really interested to see if they, take the grieving process a little further in the next season.
Yeah, I think that, and especially Tasty specifically, because she was such a big integral part of this episode.
But I think,
kind of going back to your original point, like, I do think people stay busy, especially in like the culture in the United States where like, we're always expected to be like doing something or like being busy or being industrious or whatever, you know, like we don't necessarily have that time to sit. So, being busy can also be, I don't really know if we see that a lot in this episode, but I think that's a really important point that you made, that like, being busy can also be really detrimental because if you're too busy, you're not processing.
And that's what a lot of people tend to do. And I think we can sort of move that into addiction. You know, I mean, people cope with loss in many different ways. There are healthy ways and there are not healthy ways. So delving into something 100% and in order to avoid feeling is not healthy. And people do that either with, you know, working or exercising or using drugs or alcohol. So you can see, you know, a couple of different aspects of that in this episode, you know, with the alcohol use and with the working, that people don't, I mean, who wants to really feel grief? Who wants to feel that pain? Because it's horrible. And, you know, if we're talking about addiction, and that's any type of addiction, it can be eating, it can be spending money, it can be, you know, people oftentimes do it to not feel something negative or to feel better because of something negative.
Or to feel something different, I think. Just like, even if they know that drinking is going to make them feel like, you know, eventually feel terrible or be hungover or whatever, like, you know, to feel something different than what they're feeling then, and to kind of forget about like that horrible like emptiness kind of inside of them.
Right. I don't like how I'm feeling right now, and I want to change it. Whatever that feeling is, you know, there's a benefit to whatever it is that I'm going to do. So if it's, I hate what I'm feeling right now and I want to numb it out, I just don't want to feel. And that's very, very common when we're talking about death.
I think it's different in, I mean, sort of, so we see the alcohol and we see Brooke drinking, and like, that's totally understandable. Obviously too, because it's the hooch that Poussé made. So it's like connecting her to Poussé, which is like, even that's like a whole other interesting layer to the situation. But we also see, you know, we see the girls, Cindy says, I eat, that's how I cope. And so we see the different people kind of falling into those things, and maybe not necessarily in a super unhealthy way. Like you said, we'll see kind of that play out a little bit more in future episodes, hopefully. But you know, we do see like different cultures, and I think especially with me, like as a substance abuse counselor, like alcohol can play a different role in different cultures in very different ways. So I actually don't really know much about like other, like, I mean, I kind of do, but like how other cultures grieve and how maybe they utilize alcohol in different ways or utilize food in different ways to I mean, I know, like, as someone who's like Catholic, like, we drink at wakes,
right?
Or we drink at like the funeral. And so, you know, there's like different cultures definitely deal with things in different ways and utilize food and alcohol, I think, specifically because those are so, like, those can be so comforting, or those can be such a release. I think that those get utilized in different ways throughout the world as a grieving coping mechanism.
Absolutely. And you know, I think you make a really good point with that, because oftentimes, you know, funeral services or memorial, stuff like that, is meant to be a celebration of life. And with our society and many other cultures, celebrations bring about alcohol. you know, there is certainly a piece of that. And I think it's actually interesting, because they kind of combine the Jewish religious culture and the African American culture, with Cindy talking about sitting Shiva, because it is, Shiva is a, part of the bereavement process, the grieving process, where after the burial, there's a 7-day period where the family, there's typically, I believe, one person or at least one family member that would be staying with the deceased. And then the family doesn't cook. They don't cook for the full week. And they speak the Kaddish, which is a prayer about, you know, with referencing their faith. Twice a day. And then after the 7-day period, then there's, you know, other people are welcome to come back to, again, say, like farewells, I suppose, to the deceased. And then in African American cultures, and actually in a lot of cultures, you know, people tend to bring food to the family. Mm-hmm. And you see that in African American cultures for, you know, after death and even during end of life, towards end of life, mm-hmm. family is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And church as well, religion mm-hmm. as well. So you see that, you know, people coming over and bringing the food and giving their mm-hmm. their blessings to the family, which I think was just beautiful the way that they did that.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely agree. And I think, you know, it's interesting to see, I mean, like you said, it's kind of a mixture of Shiva and, which is funny because Cindy like just converted to Judaism last season.
I know.
And she's like, but she's always popping out the Jewish references, which is hilarious. But
she is so
intrinsic to her as a character now because she's in it. She's Jewish. Like she's, you know,
yes, she is.
And so that's like so interesting about her too. And I think, you know, I think a lot of times if you grow up in a certain culture and you don't really see other grieving process or other ways of, you know, I have different friends who are different, you know, like I have friends who are Jewish and I've been to ceremony, like I'm part of Shiva, I've been to, you know, sort of all sorts of different, you know, things like, you know, different church ceremonies are longer or shorter or whatever. And it's just interesting to kind of see the disparity or like the differences in terms of how people cope with loss and different cultures and how those things have evolved.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not sure if I told you, my boyfriend is from Ghana.
Oh, okay.
And so I've gone to one funeral with him. And now I grew up Catholic. My family mm-hmm. actually owns two funeral homes. So
okay,
I'm
yeah,
familiar with, so I'm familiar with, you know, that style mm-hmm. Of funeral processions. Well,
because that's a very specific style, right? Like that's like, I mean, most people who come to funeral homes want a very specific thing.
Right. So, it, you know, my experience is, you know, within the following day or two, the individual is prepared for mm-hmm. A viewing, which they refer to as the wake. And mm-hmm. that's about, you know, a couple hours, 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And then the following day is the burial. And then typically the family and whoever is invited to the funeral go out to celebrate the life of the person. Mm-hmm. And typically the burial is anywhere from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on a Saturday mm-hmm. or Sunday. So
right.
Now my boyfriend being from Ghana, their funerals are usually held on Friday or Saturday evenings. Mm-hmm. From about 10 p.m. to 4 a.m.
Oh, really? Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah. So the first funeral that I went to was it was a relative of his. It was his cousin's grandfather who is actually considered a king.
Oh.
Who I think they have kings and queens in their towns.
Right.
Which are more not like official king or queen, but in any
just
event.
Just like a title,
so,
kind of, right?
Right. So mm-hmm. they this service was from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Wow, that's
Friday
great.
Night.
I never
yeah.
heard of like a really – what's the significance of that?
You know, I have not asked that. That's a good question. but what's fascinating, and it was absolutely beautiful, is that the family, and it includes, you know, the immediate family plus extended family, everybody wears black and red, mm-hmm. and the immediate family has a certain pattern of clothing that they wear. They
oh,
make
wow.
the clothes before.
Uh-huh.
And then the extended family has a separate pattern that they wear. And they set up these rows of tables almost in like a U shape. So there's like long rows set in a U shape and all of the family members sit at these tables. And then when you walk in, you go around the tables, you shake everybody's hand, and mm-hmm. it is very disrespectful to shake with your left hand, so you have to shake
oh, okay.
with your right hand. And then, you know, they sit and there's a series of, you know, dancing and lots of alcohol. mm-hmm. I mean, they usually have
it
in a
common thread throughout all of this.
It certainly is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's very interesting, and it's fascinating how different cultures, you know, really celebrate loss, and mm-hmm. that's what it is. It's a celebration of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's yeah. I that's beautiful, and I, you know, like I said, I've been to a couple different, I mean, we can talk about all the different, but like that's definitely like a very new one I've heard. I've never heard of a ceremony taking place at night.
Yeah,
I'm a night person, so like maybe I should put that
in
my will or whatever. Like, everyone come at night. but like that's, and it's funny because people don't, I mean, this is kind of a tangent, but people don't really like to think about like death and planning for their death and all of that. Like, cause it's such a, and I'm sure you can probably speak to that too, but
yeah.
Like my parents' 44th anniversary was yesterday. And
they
did,
congratulations!
Oh, thanks. Yeah, but what they did for their anniversary was go finalize their funeral plans.
a
funeral home locally, and my sister was like appalled, and I was just, and my husband thought it was funny, like, and like just like haha, like that's so your parent, like, you know. But I was kind of like, okay, well, if that's what they wanted to do, but like everyone like reacted to it very differently. Like I said, my sister was like almost mad because she didn't really want to think about the eventuality of death. And so I think that's like part of the difficulty of the grieving process, because especially in our culture where we don't really like to think about death, because you know other cultures kind of embrace death sometimes, I think. I don't know mm-hmm. specifically which ones, but I just know that's a thing. But our culture is, it's difficult for us to kind of wrap our minds around that, so it's hard to be like, it's even hard to think about planning for our own death, and then when someone does die, it's hard to cope with it. So I think those are all barriers to kind of grief and loss.
Absolutely. It's so taboo. It is so taboo to talk about death at all. I mean, if you think about it, even growing up, I mean, we don't talk about our own mortality. We think that we're invincible, and mm-hmm. so we do stupid things. And, you know, I mean, and that carries on. There are some cultures, particularly Asian Americans, and even Native Americans, who believe that if you talk about death, that it's more likely to happen. You know, talking about it, it's some
That's
even
totally
to
my
the
sister.
Well, some even to the extent that if somebody is dying, they won't even tell the person that they're dying, because they feel that by not telling them, they'll live longer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you tell them that they're dying, you're basically giving them their death sentence.
Oh, gosh, so, that must be hard in the medical profession.
Well, and that's also what's interesting with that, is that they tend to avoid, you know, going to doctors or, you know, even also with the African American culture, you know, they don't typically plan for end of life, because things are more dealt within the family as opposed to going to a doctor or getting treatment or using hospice. Mm-hmm. Whereas Hispanic Americans, they feel that they're much more open talking about death. Mm-hmm. They also practice this anticipatory grief, where if they feel that somebody is sick, they, you know, may begin to interpret that as they're going to die. Mm-hmm. So they begin the grieving process earlier. And what ends up happening, even at a younger age, is that they're more prepared and they're better able to cope with death as a result of that.
Huh.
Yeah. And so it's interesting, you know, you think of the Day of the Dead.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is truly a celebration, because they'll bring food to, you know, the deceased's gravesite, you know, mm-hmm. and they'll leave flowers, or, you know, it's celebrating relatives. And
all of my eighth grade Spanish class is coming back to me. Like, they make the special bread, right? Pan de los Muertos, and they bring it, and yeah, it's all flooding back. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you know, it is, I mean, if we were more open about it and really talked about it more and what is it that people wanted and what is, you know, what do we want to leave as our legacy and, you know, who are we as, you know, individuals and, you know, what values we can pass on to other people, we'd be able to cope better with it. We wouldn't necessarily be turning to drugs and alcohol. And, you know, we wouldn't have complicated grief, which becomes pathological in nature where, you know, here we are 2 years down the road thinking that, you know, my husband who died 2 years ago is going to somehow walk through the door. And I'm just stuck in, you know, this vicious cycle. And I can't even leave my house because if I leave my house, maybe he'll come home because I don't think he's actually dead.
And you know? That does, I mean, that it sounds like a specific example you're talking about, but stuff like that does happen. I mean, stuff like that happens and people have all these maladaptive behaviors to deal with grief because they don't know how to deal with it. And like in a healthy way or in a way that, that honors them as a person and lets them kind of move on.
And I think a lot of people feel that moving on with their life means that they're going to be forgetting about the person. And it's important for people to recognize that living a life that the loved one would want you to live by valuing having that person in your life is going to be more important than spending the rest of your life being upset about the loss of that person. You know, and that's one thing that I do with my patients is ask them if, you know, if so-and-so was sitting right where I am right now and hearing what you're saying right now, what would they tell you? And that oftentimes is sort of a catalyst for change. I just completed one of my patients who 4 years ago, her husband passed away. He was diagnosed and died of, cancer within 8 months. You know, she really, and she's actually the individual I was just sharing about, felt that her husband was going to come home any day. And was just really hopeless. And so we started talking about that. And she said, you know, he hated when I cried. And he told me that, you know, no matter where he ended up, he was always going to be blessing me and that he wanted me to be able to live my life. And so I said, well, what does that mean? What does that mean to be able to live your life? Are you doing that right now? And what would he want you to do? What do you want to do? More importantly, because she really has just been stuck. You know, she's not working. She's not doing anything. And that's, you know, that's important for people. Find new meaning.
And kind of just, and honor that person, but don't like live for them, live for that grief. And I think, you know, I think that's important too with, you know, just in general to honor your grief and be able to have these ceremonies or rituals that we do, because I think, you know, whether you're from Ghana or you're from wherever, like, you know, if you're Catholic or whatever, like a whole, the whole spectrum, like just for me, like knowing that there's this thing coming up that I that I'm familiar with and that will help me process the grief, it's helpful because it's like okay, well, there's going to be a funeral, or in the case like my uncle was cremated and we spread his ashes and we still had a ceremony, but it was like, you know, it's a way to kind of let things go. And I think it's important that in this episode, these women are in prison and they're not given that chance. I mean, they kind of make their own rituals, but they're, you know, the Pusey's body is loaded onto a well, first of all, she's laying in the cafeteria for a whole day. Whole day. And then she's loaded onto a stretcher and just unceremoniously put into the ambulance and driven away. And the women don't get a chance to say goodbye. They don't get a chance to do really any of that that is so common to so many cultures, which is like, you know, actually say goodbye to the body. And I think that that's a big, you know, that's a big part of the, like the missing part of that grieving process in this episode.
It is. And I think for a lot of people, even, that's where complicated grief sometimes comes into play is when you don't have closure. And that can be when, you know, when the person actually passes away, you know, if there's a traumatic experience, it's, there's not an illness, it's unplanned suicide, particularly, you know, there can, somebody might be stuck in the stage of anger because of lack of closure. But also, you know, if there is, You know, I unfortunately had a friend who did commit suicide tragic way, to the point where they couldn't even, you know, have a casket.
Right.
And so the memorial, well, the service itself was just a picture.
Right.
And it becomes really difficult for people. So yeah, I agree. The fact that, and you see in the episode too, when the ambulance comes to take the body away, you see the Hispanic women all cross themselves.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that was significant. I think for them, that was their way of saying, you know, we're blessing you. We're thinking of you.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
this is important, but yeah, I mean, it's.
And like you said, those cultures are more sort of just culturally, just by virtue of the fact that their culture is more prepared, they're a little bit more prepared for the grieving process.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, I know that the episode came at a really interesting time in our mm-hmm. society, mm-hmm. As far as Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And I think that the episode did a fantastic job of really clearly defining what happens. You know, here is this very petite Black woman who is a prisoner, who is, mm-hmm. and they're treated like prisoners, you mm-hmm. know, inmate. Mm-hmm. They don't say their
yeah,
names.
Yeah, I mean,
or,
same difference.
Right. And, you know, she is being held down to the point where, as Tacy said, she's never going to get up ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And here are these, you know, talk about the bureaucracy of the prison system, these, you know, upper level white males who are trying to spin the story so that it doesn't mm-hmm. look like they did anything wrong. And they're trying to throw so-and-so under the bus, poor Bailey, this poor guy. And, you know, I mean, just as you said, they left the body there for a day because,
yeah.
you know, oh, we can't call the police. We can't call the coroner. You know, the press can't get a hold of this. Let's figure out, you know, let's stick to the story mm-hmm. as, now I can't think of his name, Piscatella. Piscatella mm-hmm. is referencing the story. You know, and in the last couple of years, you know, we've seen young black men in general, not even just mm-hmm. young, getting shot by white police officers. And, you know, it becomes traumatic. It becomes traumatic for
right.
our society as a whole.
Yeah. And I think I'm not sure how I'm going to release the episodes, but I spoke with a woman named Jamie Broadnax from Black Girl Nerds about this situation and how some of the African-American community was very angry about the presentation of Black Lives Matter in this season of Orange is the New Black. And I think it's funny because it's not funny, but I think it's interesting because I think, kind of going back to what you were talking about, I think you said, what was it, displaced grief or disenfranchised grief?
Like disenfranchised.
The grief that you're not really allowed to feel. I mm-hmm. think that that's kind of a big part of Black Lives Matter, because I think maybe a lot of people outside of the African American community can't understand why it's so tragic for them to continue to lose these Black men and women. I mean, it, Sandra Bland was a big you know, definitely an example of a woman as well losing her life to police brutality.
You're right.
and it's I mean, it's generally men, but, you know, it can go both ways, you know,
mm-hmm.
To police brutality. And then they don't, there's not, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement kind of emerged from needing to kind of have that grieving process and have that place to talk about it and have that place to elicit change, too. And I think, you know, that's why this episode, I think it's important to talk about that specific grieving process as well, because, like I said, I think, you know, based on just what I've seen and based on my conversation with Jamie, you know, for African Americans, it was tough, and it elicited a lot of anger because it was bringing up something that they already have to deal with.
It's real. It's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it happened twice, like right after Orange is the New Black was released, it happened again, like multiple times, you know, it's happening a lot. It's happening frequently. Uh-huh. And it's a hard thing to process because, like I said, you know, I love that you gave us that term, disenfranchised grief, because I think that this Black Lives Matter definitely falls into that because not everyone understands it.
And I do agree with you on that. And I mean, it's, again, I think it's the way that our society is run that, you know, mm-hmm. people, oftentimes people who don't experience things firsthand, they aren't really going to understand it as much. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people may be looking at this situation, as far as Black Lives Matter, you know, they may not see it as much of an issue as it actually is. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right. No, that's good. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on too. Like, I mean, in this episode, that's why, you know, I definitely wanted to separate the grief and loss part from the actual narrative of the episode. I mean, it's ingrained in the narrative of the episode, but I think it was important to kind of pull that out and talk about that as well, especially since it was one of the first deaths on the show, you know, that we had Trisha in season one, but we weren't nearly as connected to her as we are to Poussey. And I think Poussey, the choice of Poussey, as well as you know, the because obviously this isn't real. I mean, it's set in a very real setting, but you know, the writers had to choose to kill Poussey and right. the method of which she was killed too. So, you know, I think that all kind of enveloped in the Black Lives Matter movement in a very like obvious way that, you know, maybe didn't really vilify the person that, you know, killed Poussey. You know, Bailey, we have, you know, you and I have sympathy for Bailey, but other, you know, people like don't necessarily have that sympathy for Bailey. So it's tough. Like it's they made it very complex. So it was hard to, you know, it was hard to make those decisions. And it was hard to kind of place your grief in the right box. I think.
Well, and I mean, Black Lives Matter, the whole issue, it's so real within our society. And I mean, I could spend an awful lot of time talking about how racism is still very, very much alive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you look at history, we've gone from overt racism to covert racism, mm-hmm. you know, where things happen that maybe aren't intentional, but are swept under the rug and people mm-hmm. aren't held accountable the way that they should be. Mm-hmm. You know, just like this episode clearly shows that they're trying to place blame on, you know, not the system, you know, of the prison guards, but on one particular individual who it really wasn't his fault, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that in all honesty, the fact that it had to take a certain number of, you know, Black lives to end for a group to come together to make large change, that is again how our society works. Mm-hmm. You know, there is power in numbers, and I'm hoping that, you know, that there's larger scale changes as far as police brutality goes. You know, people, they need to be educated. They need to have mm-hmm. training around more cognitive behavioral things, you mm-hmm. know, because what people don't recognize is that when we're in a really heightened emotional state, we're not thinking rationally, mm-hmm. right? So this, you know, Bailey in this episode, he's getting assaulted, attacked mm-hmm. by another inmate. We can't think of two things at the same time. Our brain mm-hmm. isn't capable of doing that. So, well, he's trying to defend himself. He's not also thinking, oh crap, my knee is on, you know, this inmate's right. neck. You know, mm-hmm. he's trying to defend himself.
Right.
Same kind of thing with our society when, you know, a police officer, and I'm not a police officer, I've never been held at gunpoint. You know, mm-hmm. I have no idea what my body or my brain would do mm-hmm. if somebody pulled a gun on me, or I thought somebody was going to pull a gun on me.
Right.
I just know that being a human And being a rational person who is competent and capable of making decisions, we have this fight or flight instinct.
Mm-hmm. That and you never know what you're going to do.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. If I feel threatened, I'm probably going to react.
Right.
And there are ways to be able to prepare for that. I mean, mm-hmm. we can never predict what's going to happen, but we can certainly plan and prepare. And mm-hmm. police officers need to have, you know, that type of training. So right. what happens when,
and guards
you know,
as well.
What's that?
And, you know, prison guards as well. I know, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this situation, Bailey was never, I mean, Bailey, it was like a totally grossly negligent amount of training that Bailey had had. And I know,
exactly.
you know, just based
what
on,
training?
Yeah, like no training. And I know based on, I don't know if you read that article that Shane Bauer wrote in Mother Jones about he went undercover as a prison guard in a private prison for 4 months.
I heard about that, but no,
yeah,
I haven't read
really,
it.
Yeah, it's really great. But he talks about how they gave him a month of training, and you know, months sounds like a long time, but like you know, if I think about me, I went to 6 years of higher education in order to
right?
be a substance abuse counselor who doesn't even deal with you know, life and I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes there's a crisis, but it's not a situation generally where, you know, something is going to happen where my fight or flight is going to be kicked into gear. But
right.
I think, you know, he had 1 month of training, and the Department of Justice for the prisons that are underneath the umbrella of the Department of Justice that aren't private prisons, they require 3 years of 3 months of training. And so, you know, there's a disparity there. And there's also a disparity between that and the training that Bailey received. So it's understandable that he would panic in a situation like that. And he's young and he's kind of dumb. Like, he's not really a smart kid. Like,
he's simple.
He's a simple guy.
He's
a simple kid. And so, you know, he's, and I definitely understand the, anger over the you know, how people are feeling sympathetic towards him, especially since he did you know, kill Poussey, who is a beloved
right.
character. But I also think, you know, there are shades of gray with some of the police officers even who have killed people in you know, accidentally in the line of duty. Like, I know the police officer who killed Philando Castile was, you know, he was Latino, he wasn't even white, and he was panicking. You could hear it. Like, I actually don't watch those videos, but I know many people told me you could hear that he was panicking from his, just like, you know, sometimes you just go into a panic mode. So I, you know, personally, you know, I don't have, I'm not African American, I'm white. Like, obviously, like, I connect to the Black Lives Matter. Like, I fully support that mission, and I see where things are going wrong in society, but I also see where it's actually realistic what happened with Bailey. Like, I do think that that
oh,
is
yeah.
a situation that could happen and does happen. Like, there's a gentleman, I talked about this on a previous podcast, but I think it's really important. A gentleman named Darius Robinson was recently killed in Oklahoma prison with illegal chokeholds and pepper spray from untrained guards who didn't
yeah.
know how to control him. And he wasn't in for a violent offense. He was, he had not paid his child support, and he died. And it's
yeah.
like, you know, these untrained guards, like, who knows? Maybe they were trying to kill him. I don't really know. I don't know. But my guess would be no, but like, you know, it happened, and it's tragic and it's terrible, and it's something that we need to address. And like you said, I think circling back, training is definitely the most important part of that.
We have to be able to look at these things on a macro level. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. that there are bad people. I mean, there are, of course, there are bad people out there,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's a much larger scale issue. And one of the things that this is a really important topic to me, and I can mm-hmm. certainly spend a lot of time racism in general, because it is such a larger scale issue. People need to be educated, and people need mm-hmm. to be trained. People also need to realize that if we're only looking at these really horrifying videos of, you know, police brutality, there's also a flip side to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's also the videos that we don't see of kindness,
mm-hmm.
you know, people doing good things. You know, and it just so happens that, again, this is certainly something that's very important to me. All of these shootings or events with the Black Lives Matter have been happening over, have become more public I suppose, in the last couple of years, but it's been going on forever. It's just that people are now paying more attention and documenting these incidents that are happening. But it doesn't mean that now all of a sudden it's happening. And it also doesn't mean that it's not happening to other populations of people, because it is. That's and there are also good things that are being done every day, but that stuff doesn't make news because it's not as entertaining. People don't care about, you know, the police officer that helped the old lady walk across the street. People care about the police officer who beat the old lady to death. Right. You know? So
yeah, and the 24-hour news cycle is definitely a big, you know, although it has brought attention to the Black Lives Matter movement, which is great, but like at the same time, like you said, it's all the negative, and the past couple of podcasts we've been talking about this, like all the negative stuff that goes on and how the media spins it and how the media makes people feel about it. And you know, it's, you know, a more positive, I think. And I think, you know, in this episode, if we come back to that a little bit, I think we see, you know, we see this horrible, horrific thing that happens, but we also see acts of kindness, which is kind of nice. Like, we see people bring, you know, Cindy and Watson and Allison the food and sort of try in their own way to make things, you know, a little easier on them. And we see those little acts of kindness in this episode, and throughout Orange is the New Black in general, we see people connecting and we see people making those positive, you know, positive changes. And so I really like Orange is the New Black. I know some people, you know, the death was very polarizing for people, whether it was because it made them angry or it made them upset or it made them, you know, a lot of different things. But I really feel like for me personally, it was very effective. But if we kind of just move into, we were talking a little bit before and I was saying, like, grief for fictional characters is kind of hard for me because it's hard because there's no like set, you know, there's no set thing. And not to say that it's like the death of a pet or a miscarriage or Black Lives Matter or anything, but I think that's another thing that might fall under the disenfranchised grief, because
it certainly is.
Yeah, because a lot of people deal with it, and a lot of people, like, will stop watching shows because their favorite character died. They feel betrayed. They feel, you know, I don't know if you've ever really talked about that with anyone, but maybe clients like I said too, like celebrities who die, sometimes it's really hard for people. Like when Prince died or David Bowie died, like especially musical icons, I think it's hard for people. So, you know, how do you feel about that? Like fictional, like the process of mourning a fictional character?
You know, I think it absolutely falls under disenfranchised grief. And typically, the way that we grieve is all dependent on our relationship to the loss. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, if it's more difficult for us to move towards acceptance, for example, it's generally because there's a lot of meaning, a lot of importance behind that individual or whatever it was that was lost. So the fictional character, for example, Poussey in this episode, may have reminded you of somebody close to you, maybe even yourself. You had an emotional attachment to the character. You know, same with a pet. We were talking about pets before. You know, I mean, there is an emotional connection. It's very important to you. And it's not, I mean, obviously she's a very good actress, and as are most of the characters in the episode, but, you know, I think it's just as you would with somebody in your own life passing away, you have to be able to pay attention to what you've gained from that, the person or whatever it was that you lost. I try to generalize it because some people haven't lost an individual, but they may have lost, you know, their children, right? To DCF or something. So you have to
that's
be able to, oh yeah, I know. Yeah. I've grown accustomed to generalizing, not just a loss of a person, but loss in general. You know, what was the significance about having that person or experience in your life? And also, you know, just as any type of, traumatic experience or really difficult experience, what have you gained from the experience itself? Because more often than not, the most difficult things that we've had to encounter in our lives are the times that have brought about the most change positively. Mm-hmm. You know, we learn more about ourselves. We may be introduced to, you know, a new skill, a new hobby, a new person, somebody that maybe we haven't met, and unfortunately had to meet them under these really negative circumstances, mm-hmm. but we're better off as a result. So being able to see the positive in something really negative.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a great point too, because I'm trying to think of like a fictional, besides Poussette, like I just in general, like I'm trying to think of one that I really had a super hard time with, but, they're probably like silly ones, but like I watched The Walking Dead. Like I love The Walking Dead. I like Game of Thrones. I knew Ned Stark was going to die, so I didn't feel too bad about that one. But, oh, sorry. I hope you watch Game of Thrones, or at least you know.
Oh, I do. I do.
Oh, okay. But like it's a lot of times, and I think I see it too because I'm on Twitter a lot and Facebook, and like I hear people like having issues with different people who die on TV, and it's something that's happening more often too. Like I know I don't watch Grey's Anatomy, but I know like when McDreamy died, people were so upset, and like it's hard.
He died. No, I'm just kidding.
That was like on the actual news.
I know. I haven't gotten to that episode yet but I heard it a long time ago. I'm just teasing.
But I think I think people have a hard time, and I think your point about like what did you gain from this person, and like why, like how can you move on? Like, so would that be like how you would like talk to someone about kind of getting through that process of grieving a fictional character?
Absolutely. Same as I would talk to somebody about getting through the process of losing a real person. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you have to be able to look at it not as a void, but as a learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, so what is it, again, that you have learned from this person? What are new values? What are, you know, and sharing stories, you know, so talking about some of, you know, the things that she did that was silly. I think that the flashback of her life, mm-hmm. In this episode was fantastic, because it was really, I mean, what an enlightening day that this girl had on this day. You know, here she is, she's, you know, hanging out with these transvestites and, you know, at this really cool club dancing. And then, right? Yeah. I want a bike ride with drunk and high Buddhists, because yeah. How fun is that? But, I mean, it's, you know, it's really being able to, like I said, find the good in the really bad. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like how I feel anytime an animal dies in a movie. Oh, I mean,
another big one, I think.
Yeah, I can watch a movie and people can die left and right, but if that dog dies, I'm turning it off. I can't.
I
can't do it, because there's this innocence, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, with animals, forget it. It's unconditional love. They're mm-hmm. innocent. They did nothing wrong. And same thing when a beloved character dies, if we see that it was, you know, a wrongdoing, or, you know, there's no justification, or there's no closure, there's these unanswered questions, or they were a mm-hmm. good person, you know, I mean, it's our own perception of the situation and how we interpret all of the information that surrounds the loss, that gauges how we deal with it. Mm-hmm. But being able, again, to look at the really good things is certainly helpful. Yeah, and share it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And talk about it with other people.
I mean, the fact that you have this podcast and people mm-hmm. can listen to it and share their, you know, their thoughts on it, if people need to comment on it, I mean, that's the place to do it. Same with Black Lives Matter. I just want to go back to that real quick. I have a former patient of mine who, African-American woman, has a 22-year-old son. And anytime one of these stories would come on the news, she would get so distraught, you know, practically to the point of feeling suicidal, or maybe wanting to hurt somebody else. And at one point when she was healthy, she had been a member of a number of government organizations to sort of help, you know, build society, help, you know, with support groups. And she said, you know, I cannot learn how to let go of things that are beyond my control, because that's something that I talk about a lot in treatment.
That's very insightful, actually, of her.
It's really important. The Serenity Prayer, break it down, learn it, own it, all that stuff. But she said, these things I know, there's nothing that I can do about it, but it still really bothers me. So, you know, I said to her, take what you can and leave the rest. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is really important to you because you have a 22-year-old son and you fear for him because things happen, you know, randomly, even though he's a good kid and abides by society. So the things that you can control are, number one, when you watch or read these news stories. So don't do them, you know, don't watch or read them first thing in the morning. Don't watch or read them right before you go to bed. Plan that time. So plan that time to maybe watch certain episodes that might have an emotional impact on you. Number two, share that information with other people that find it just as important as you do. So talk to people about it. Don't keep it to yourself. Share it. Because there is one thing, compassion. I'll get into that in a second. Compassion is one of the leading causes of happiness. Compassion is what builds resilience to stress and helps us to get through trauma. Being able to share with like-minded people. And the other thing I said to her is, you as one individual may not be able to change this issue, but you can join other people who, as a group, will be able to change this issue. So, again, being around like-minded people and caring about it and trying to do something about it on a larger scale is something that you have control over.
Definitely.
So yeah, I think that that's important.
That is important. And I think even though Orange is the New Black was kind of polarizing for people in terms of Black Lives Matter, I do think, like you said, like, I do think that it elicited those, I mean, it elicited conversations for sure. Like, obviously, like, I love Orange is New Black. I wanted to talk about it in the context of, like, you know, real life situations. And that's why we're talking now. But like, there are other people too that I think disagreed with the show and were very angry by it. And they sought out other people to talk to about the situation. And I think, you know, by virtue of the fact that this even happened on a TV show, it's starting conversations one way or another. Like, I was really pleased by the way Black Lives Matter was portrayed, or I was not pleased. And I think people are finding each other and having those conversations and maybe eliciting change.
And I think that happens in, you know, in real life with major issues like that, too, that become public knowledge. And that's how, I mean, if we really were to break it down, everything is polarized, right? Everybody has a difference of opinion on every single matter, every single thing in life, right? Not everybody is going to be 100% in agreement on one thing. You know, this episode, or well, the last episode, episode 12, really, it did. It brought people together to be able to talk about things. And as I was saying before, with compassion, right? So compassion, first of all, being able to connect with somebody on an emotional level releases oxytocin. Oxytocin is what they call the cuddle hormone, and it makes you want to be able to create bonds with people. And being able to do that, as I mentioned before, creates resiliency. So if you think about, like, some of the largest natural disasters, right, or traumatic experiences, particularly in this episode, at the very end, you see everybody coming together. It creates new bonds, and it makes big changes. it brings people together that maybe ordinarily wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You know, think about Orlando or Katrina or, you know, in this episode, I mean, there's every race has their clique. And at the very end, every race comes together and poor Judy looked like she was going to have a heart attack. But, you know, that it brings and builds and creates, and it's a beautiful thing. And unfortunately, most times it takes bad things to happen. But that's where finding the good from the experience is important, as I, you know, was saying before.
Right. Yeah. And thinking about, you know, thinking about little changes that can happen too. Like, I think, you know, in coming together and finding other people and finding those connections, like, because sometimes I don't think we can always necessarily, like your client, like, or patient, she doesn't necessarily think that she can elicit like a large change, obviously, that would change, you know, these police brutality things from happening, or, you know, make sure her own son is even safe, that's terrifying to me, you know, like, I don't have children, but like, that is a terrifying thought to me. But kind of finding what she can control and then making those bonds and increasing her compassion and getting to know people and kind of, you know, making her life have meaning through there instead of just, you know, feeling terrified, because it's not fun to feel terrified all the time or feel sad all the time, or, you know, and it's hard to get out of that sometimes, I think, especially, you know, dealing with people with depression or addiction. It's hard to get out of those maladaptive patterns of behavior, but trying to reach out to other people is definitely a step in the right direction. And I think your point about sharing is definitely really important.
And you actually bring me to something that I completely forgot. A lot of people are afraid to ask for help or are afraid to talk about things that they might be feeling. And for anybody who's listening to this, for everybody who's listening to this, there is no shame in asking for help, in talking to people about what is going on. I actually have a current patient who is going to be successfully completing on Monday, who, you know, attempted suicide a couple months ago. And he was raised, as a lot of men in our society are, he was raised to not show emotion. You know, he's a guy. Guys don't show emotion. It's not something that you do. So when he was feeling really depressed and suicidal, he didn't think, first of all, that he could tell anybody, because he was afraid that he would be judged, or, you know, he'd be told to, oh, just get over it. You know, it's not a big deal. Like, whatever. Just
or
go
like,
do
what's
something.
Wrong with you?
And, right. Mm-hmm. And so he made an attempt, and, you know, learning one of the things that I really help people to focus on is, you know, what is your reason for living? You know, keep working on that. Keep finding out what is important to you and do it and let go of everything else. Stop setting expectations about things and just enjoy the process. And he was able to do just that. And he realized that it was okay to talk about, you know, his mental illness. It was okay to talk about his medical illness. And he was able to share that with not only his wife, his parents and his sons. And so now he knows, you know, he has this plan in place for, you know, if I were to ever feel this way again, I know who I can reach out to. So, you know, knowing that it's okay to talk to people about how you feel, you know, you're going to make more connections and you're going to surprise yourself too. Because a lot of times you might find, oh, this person's going to make fun of me because, you know, I'm really upset about this fictional character that just died. And you're going to find other people that are like, oh my God, I was thinking the same thing.
Exactly. So yeah, for sure.
Everybody is out there that you can connect with. There are always people. Always, always, always.
That's definitely true. And yeah, it was funny because I was going to definitely ask you about like, how can we help other people going through the grief process? But I think, you know, I think you definitely like nailed it. Like, you know, make sure that they feel like they can share and make sure that I think if we go all the way back to the beginning of the conversation, like you said, treating everyone like an individual is really important and kind of meeting yes. people where they're at with their grieving process instead of saying like, you need to be doing X, Y, and Z, being like, okay, how are you feeling? And like, what do you want? Like, what do you want to change about that?
Yeah, and helping people to reminisce, mm-hmm. to talk about the good things, the good experiences that they had with the person or the situation, mm-hmm. And you know, just listening. Sometimes people don't need advice. Sometimes people don't need suggestions. Sometimes mm-hmm. people just want an ear to be able to vent to. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, not putting pressure on getting them to move on, but mm-hmm. encouraging them to create new meaning, find things that they're interested in that they can engage in, particularly with other people. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think it's important to keep the memory alive of the deceased, because I think right. that really is I found to be most important for people being able to reorganize their lives, accept loss, is, you know, keeping the memory alive by either honoring them through living their own life or sharing stories, or just, you know, remembering that they're there. Create a garden for them.
Yeah.
You know,
like
things
Red did. Rebuild our
exactly.
hope.
Exactly. I loved that too.
Yeah, that was great.
Right. Reading, you know, I mean, she mm-hmm. loved the library. Oh, poor Suzanne, covering herself in books.
I know.
Covering mm-hmm. herself in books to feel closer and to feel protected. Mm-hmm. You know, those are, I wouldn't say that that's unhealthy. I think that that was actually very healthy until, of course, the entire bookcase fell on top of her. But you know, if she wants to do that for a short period of time to feel closer connected, that's great. When it continues over the course of, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, that's when it becomes problematic. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's important for your listeners to know that a typical, and there is no normal or typical grief period, but what society, I suppose, would say is normative is generally about a year. Mm-hmm. And what becomes complicated grief is this feeling that the deceased will return. You know, if that carries over past 6 months or a year.
Right.
You know, or you're really unable to move forward and completely stuck in the grief is when it becomes more problematic. And that's when it's important to really talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say, you know, and like the group that you run, I think groups are really important in order to process grief too, because you need to know that other people are kind of dealing with the same thing. And like you said, like reaching out with like a fictional character or reaching out with you know, any sort of thing, like you mentioned miscarriages before, like the internet is, you know, the internet is awful in some ways, terrible, but in some ways it's really, really great because,
you're
you
right.
know, people
yep.
can reach out and like there are communities for women that are having miscarriages or communities for people that are mourning fictional characters or people
yes,
who
there are
mourning pets or, you know, there's all sorts of these different communities, you know, if whatever you want, you can find it and you can reach out to people and sort of go from there. So it's nice to know that, you know, there's strength in numbers.
There is, and there are resources available. Most hospitals now do have support groups for women that have had miscarriages or stillbirths. So, you know, that's something that's good to know. I would imagine that there's probably support groups for fictional characters if you were to just Google fictional character. But then also people can check out ADEC's website, which is ADEC.org. Again, that's the Association for Death Education and Counseling. And they will likely have, you know, support groups for bereaved or, you know, you can even just Google bereavement support groups, grief support groups, or call local churches or funeral homes. They might be able to point you in the right direction.
Oh, nice. Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you gave us all that information because, sure. I mean, it's good because, you know, I mean, grief is something that it's a universal thing. Like, we all experience grief. We all experience loss at some point or another. And I think it's important to know how to deal with that, especially, you know, in a society that maybe doesn't put a premium on the actual feeling grief and the actual process. So yeah, that was very helpful. And I think that's a good place to end all the places we can go to help find, you know, process our grief. But this is a great conversation and thanks so much for taking the time out to talk to us.
I'm so glad that you reached out to me. I was like, how cool is this? It's something that is really important to me. I like being able to talk about with people because more people need to talk about it. Like I said, it's too taboo, but it, death and taxes, it happens to everybody, right? We can't avoid it. It is part of our life. You know, don't be ashamed to talk about it and don't be ashamed to, you know, research what you can do about it. So,
exactly.
Thank you, Erin. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Yeah, and listeners can find us on Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, at Facebook at facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast, and you can always email us at you've got time podcast@gmail.com. So thanks so much. Bye.